Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. I am Leona Abraham Brando, host for Blog Talk Radio, Shedding Light. We are going to have with us today two special guests, someone who spent 16 years in prison on a wrongful conviction, was eventually exonerated and moved on to earning his master's degree in criminal justice, becoming a lawyer, and starting his own nonprofit organization. Our guest, Jeffrey Deskovic, is a strong advocate who founded Foundation for Justice, which helped others to also be exonerated. With Jeffrey, we also have Leslie Robinson, who we want to welcome, and she and Jeffrey are co-owners of Recharge Beyond the Bars Reentry Game. The game facilitates formerly incarcerated with friends and family. Without any further ado, we are going to welcome our guests, Leslie Robinson and Jeffrey Deskovic, to tell us more about his experiences, both negative and positive, that led him on this journey around the country to bring awareness while helping others and wrongfully convicted victims of injustice to be vindicated. We live in a country that is so unjust. The sentencing is harsh. There are so many people incarcerated on wrongful convictions. There are first-time offenders who were victims before becoming offenders. There's so much injustice going on in the prisons today, medical, psychological, spiritual. So we're going to welcome our guest today. Again, it's Leslie Robinson, and it is Jeffrey Deskovic. And Jeffrey, I hope that I pronounced that name correctly. And I want to welcome both of you on the show.
Thank you very much. And yes, you did. You did pronounce it correct.
Thank you so much.
Hi, can you hear me, Leona?
Yes, I can, Leslie. Do you want to start with a little bit about yourself, and then Jeffrey can take
over?
Yeah.
I'm trying to get on. I've called and clicked everything, but it doesn't seem to be connecting me. Do you want me to just use the phone?
Yeah. Did you receive the invitation?
Yes. Yes, and I clicked on it, and I clicked everything and connect to the broadcast, and it's saying call connected 228. I don't know what I'm doing wrong.
You're probably not doing anything wrong. We've been having problems with it, and I have notified Mandolin, who is one of the administrators of the whole entire show. I let her know a couple of weeks ago, and she was going to resolve the issue. This has been ongoing with others as well.
Okay.
But as long as you're able to call in, unfortunately, we have people from other countries on the show at times, and they can't just call in, you know, from another country.
Yeah.
So it's been pretty frustrating.
Yeah.
But we can hear you fine, and I hope you can hear us. If you can't, just let me know.
No, I just got all dressed up. Yes, I can hear you fine.
Okay.
Pleasure to meet you. So you'd like me to say a few words?
Yeah, tell us a little bit about yourself. And also, I wanted to find out more about the Recharge Beyond the Bars that you and Jeffrey founded.
Right, absolutely. So I'm a therapist in private practice. I spent 30 years working in homeless shelters, runaway shelters for homeless youth, supervising residences for homeless young adults. I was a Department of Defense reintegration specialist, where I learned a great deal also pertaining to reentry. I did a two-year volunteer poetry project at Rikers Island for women 35 years ago. Was second volunteer ever allowed into Rikers. They didn't used to allow people from the outside, and that was an incredible experience, working with 50 to 100 women every 2 weeks, with them just doing their poetry and letting it all out. So through all these experiences, my own childhood trauma, and decades of my own therapy, I created communication healing games so that people have the opportunity to have very deep healing conversations with one another, with people in their own lives in a structured way. There's a mixture of fun things and deep things, so people are laughing and crying and just having a whole journey together that helps break through stigma and defenses and helps people to open up. So I met Jeffrey, gosh, I don't know how long ago it was, Jeff, about 10 years ago?
I think that's about right, yeah.
Yeah, and I think it was just an idea at that time. But anyway, I developed I had developed already a few games, quote games, healing restorative communication games, and had the idea to do one for prison reentry. And Jeff and I met. And so I developed Recharge Beyond the Bars. The website is rechargethegame.com, rechargethegame.com, where you can get a lot of information. Jeff was moved to step in and to be my financial partner and to help me to move it forward in the world and, you know, to advise me and to financially back it. So I was very, very fortunate to be able to start on this journey, which is moving in a lot of different directions now, but that was the beginning of it. And we've had a long friendship, had the opportunity to travel all over the United States together, including the rodeo at Angola, Louisiana State Pen. That's a whole other story. But thank you for giving me this opportunity, Liana.
Well, we'll hear more from you in a little while as well. But, you know, with Jeffrey's case, I mean, his situation is, it's not unique because there are so many out there that have been wrongfully convicted, and some are still sitting in a prison cell, even though they've been, their conviction's been overturned. But Jeffrey, your situation is unique in one way. You came out and you went right into it, full force, and got your master's in criminal justice. You became a lawyer, and everything that you've done is so unique for someone that spent 16 years in prison for a crime he did not commit.
Yeah, I thank you. Yeah, so I agree with you. My case is definitely not unique. I mean, there's been 2,796 exonerations since 1989 per the National Registry of Exonerations. So you're right. That, you know, really what's more rare is the fact that I made it out, and, you know, people who made it out with, you know, were the ones that there's still many more of us still left on the inside. But, you know, I feel very fortunate to have had some educational opportunities that other people haven't had. And so I do feel a strong moral responsibility to do what I can. You know, in terms of fighting wrongful conviction and also in support of general criminal justice reform, and hence getting the master's degree and, you know, becoming a lawyer and starting the Jeffrey Deskovic Foundation for Justice. I mean, we have been able to free 10 people and help pass 3 laws and DNA database expansion, videotaping interrogation, identification reform. As part of the It Could Happen to You coalition, we were able to pass 4 additional laws, so oversight of prosecutors, a tweak of that, and improvement in discovery reform, which pertains to sharing information by both sides, and then automatic expungement in Pennsylvania. I am kind of unique because, I mean, normally someone's either a professional in the field or you're someone who's impacted. You're generally not both, but I have been able to do both.
You've done excellent work, and I wanted to say, apparently Leslie dropped, and this, again, is probably because of the radio show itself, but she'll be able to call back in. We have a couple of callers, and I don't
know. I'm still here.
Okay, so you must have dropped, and it just said that you dropped. But we have a couple of other callers here. If you want to state your name or if you have a comment to make before we get more information from Jeffrey and from Leslie. Or they're probably just listening in. But what I was going to say, you've done work in Pennsylvania. Remember in 2007, I actually went out to Pennsylvania. We were doing national work at the time, and there were 3 prisoners, young prisoners, that were being kept in the hole. And I reached out to ACLU, and I reached out to other lawyers, law firms, civil rights, to try to get help for these prisoners. And you know, I get the same thing all the time from a lot of these people. They don't have the funds. They don't have the manpower. You know, they don't have the resources. And after each one of those prisoners were alleged to have committed suicide, I called again until the last one, the third one. I even contacted some of the politicians. And one of the politicians said if she had known, she would have had an investigation going on into that prison. And I wrote to her and I said she knew, because not only did I call her, but I also emailed her. And she was saying that the bodies were cremated, which they weren't. So I told her in the email, I said, you need to talk to the family members before you tell the media things like this. What happened is I put on a rally at the Capitol Rotunda in Harrisburg. and her spokesperson was there. And I asked her at the end, what is it that your, you know, your Leanna Washington has against me? And she said, who are you? And I told her. And she said, oh, you're the one that called her a liar. And I said, no, I don't call politicians liars. I said, but she's talking to the media, and she's saying the bodies were cremated when she never even met with the prisoners, nor did she meet with the family members. So then the spokesperson came, and she put her arms around me, you know, for thanking me and everything. But this really upsets me, because there are lawyers out there. And like I say, with you, Jeff, you came out of prison. You became a lawyer, and already you've helped 10 people to be exonerated. When we have lawyers that talk about what they do, they have a website with all the things that they do, and you don't see them taking cases. In my organization, we're taking a lot of cases these lawyers are turning down, and we're not lawyers. We do extensive research to find lawyers, to find pro bono civil rights lawyers, to find pro bono appellate lawyers, to find pro bono post-conviction lawyers, find pro bono criminal lawyers. That's all we can do, and write letters and email. But the ones that should be doing something are the ones that are sitting in on coalitions and going before the media to try to get their names known rather than actually do anything. This is why I give you so much respect and credit, because not only did you come out and start, become a lawyer, go to college, but you have this recharge beyond the bars. And I'd like to hear more about that from both of you.
Leslie, why don't you go first?
Yeah, absolutely. So as I was saying before, it's a card deck with 360 questions, 160 questions about incarceration, and 200 questions about life. So it's used in many different types of settings. It's used in maximum security units, right on to in families when people come back home, and with friends. And the reason that it's mixed in with questions about life and about incarceration is that, you know, you don't want to get too bogged down and depressed. I mean, people are depressed enough, right, with all the challenges. So the questions about life allow family members, friends to also be very engaged and opening up and talking and dreaming and engaging with the formerly incarcerated person, either inside or outside. And it immediately bridges barriers and distance. And so a lot of people like Jeff have been locked up for a long time, and they come home and there's just a huge, and Jeff can speak to this, a huge chasm and communication challenges. So this really helps to move into that space and to provide an enjoyable way to have deep, meaningful conversations with one another. I'll give you a few examples. So say one question. So the questions about incarceration have a gear in front of them. Everything else has nothing. So you'll know that formerly incarcerated people will answer the questions with the gear. Do you ever feel worried you're not going to be able to make it? Explain. So, you'll get to share what's going on inside of you. When did you feel most lost? How did you cope? You know, so there gives opportunity to really get deep and really be empathetic and compassionate. Now, if everybody's been formally incarcerated, everybody answers everything, and that's, you know, mostly inside and in reentry programs. And then there's also fun interactions. And then an important part that I know Jeff loves is there's appreciation chips. So everybody starts with 7. And if you feel moved by anything anybody says, you give them chips so they feel validated, because a lot of people feel very, very anxious when they open up or are vulnerable, especially after years of being shut down. So when everybody in the group is giving them these chips, it makes everybody laugh. It makes everybody feel good. So that dynamic. So it's really, really created to have, you know, bring back joy and playfulness and deep conversations and all kind of things.
Wow. Yeah. So what I wanted to jump in and just say, in terms of the 10 people, just to make it quick. So we freed 10 of those. 3 were exonerations. one of them is someone who's out now, but is pending retrial. A few, 5 other people were paroled despite maintaining their innocence, and another case ended in the nolo contender. So we did free 10, but we exonerated 3, just to make that minor clarification. But in terms of recharge, and by the way, as you know, Leona, you know, in order to make parole while you're maintaining innocence is extremely hard to do. There are people who are almost always denied. But in terms of recharge and the gear questions, what I wanted to add is when I was released, you know, it was a communication barrier between me, and my extended family, the overwhelming majority of which never came to see me, and the few that did, it was the visits were few and far between. Mm-hmm. And it was hard for me to communicate with them and also with new people I met because I knew that nothing in their experience would have enabled them to understand, you know, what it is to be arrested, to go through a trial, to be in prison, to have to experience all the difficulties associated with reentry, from the psychological after effects to the stigma to, feeling like you're in a parallel world where technology is different and culture is different and cities don't look the same and people and neighborhoods aren't there anymore. So with all that, I couldn't communicate really with them or with other people. And, you know, one of the things that Recharge does is that it removes that awkwardness. You know, it was easier for me to communicate. And I remember once my brother told me, he said, I don't know what to say. I don't know what not to say. I don't know what to ask. I don't know what not to ask. So Recharge kind of steps in the middle and removes the awkwardness by posing the icebreaker type of questions. And every time I play it, I feel more connected with everyone I play, whether that's other formerly incarcerated people or, you know, new people who have never been directly justice impacted, or even friends and family. So I use Recharge quite a bit myself in my personal life.
I'm glad you mentioned that, Jeff, because that was going to be one of my questions to you. I know that when people go into prison, unfortunately, family do distance themselves. I think sometimes it's because of pride. I think it's sometimes it's because of fear. It's happened with a lot of us in our other advocates as well across the country. And it's really sad because prisoners, and I don't like to say prisoners, the incarcerated individuals need their family so much. And I remember a couple of lawyers saying one time, a prisoner got life without parole for a first-time offense, never being involved with the law before, never involved with substances, in college, doing so well, and got life without. And I remember a couple of lawyers saying, if the family was there, he probably would not have gotten that sentence. But to be in a courtroom by yourself or with one or two people, when the courtroom is full of others, witnesses, they're full of other, you know, the victims' families and friends, and it's really sad that these people stand alone and they get sentences like that. I wanted to also ask you, when you were inside, can you tell us a little bit about some of the things that you saw in the prison?
No, please finish your sentence. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt you.
I'm sure you know what I'm trying to get to, the things that you saw.
Yeah, sure. And to build off your point, and then I'll get right into the prison in the conversation, not in real life, by the way, a little dark humor. Because I earned that right, because I'm going to be stressed out if I don't, okay? But community ties is a factor in determining what's, you know, it is part of the pre-sentence report, so it is taken into account by judges. And community support is also something that's taken into account by parole boards, and it does assist in predicting who's going to, if you have family ties and community support, you have a better chance of transitioning to a crime-free life. But, you know, while I was in prison, I saw a lot of disturbing things, and, you know, I did mention them there's a documentary short about me called Conviction, which is on Amazon Prime, and I used the platform I had on that to shed light on that. So I saw things like, you know, just a lot of prisoner abuse, you know, on the part of the guards, and, you know, solitary confinement. I actually experienced solitary confinement, which is a form of torture. They keep you in a cell 23 hours a day. The light is on all the time. You can't control it. There's no clock. You can't see the outside. So the only way I knew what time of the day it was if there was breakfast items on the tray, and I was thrown there because I was defending myself against people that were coming to stab me, because as far as they were concerned, I was a sex offender, you know, and you can't purchase food items. And if you're not awake when the guards come by with the food, they walk right past you. And, you know, they wouldn't feed you. So I experienced that. The medical care was terrible. There was a tremendous amount of prisoner-on-prisoner violence. The administration seemed to have no interest at all whatsoever in preventing preventing that. I mean, sometimes they would cause it. Sometimes the correctional officers would talk about people's cases to the other incarcerated people, hoping that that would motivate them to commit assaults. The food in prison was terrible. Sometimes it was not fully cooked. At other times, it was burned. At still other times, there was problems with portion control. So, you know, there were elderly people in prison. Some of them were so sick, they were living on the hospital, okay, on the prison grounds. Others were in a certain medical wing. I mean, they were bedridden, dialysis, literally pushed around in wheelchairs, walking over, hunched over with canes. And where prison's a place where basic dignity and constitutional and state rights are things that just basic kindness and empathy are a rare thing, such that they're celebrated, the simplest of things. So I feel so strongly against everything I experienced and what I saw of other happening to other people that were incarcerated, because people are sent to prison as punishment. The punishment is supposed to be the loss of your freedom. It's not to be mistreated while you're there. And too many, all in the name of the, you know, and too many times that's what happens, and society looks the other way, all in the name of whatever charge, whatever offense it is that was committed or alleged to have been committed.
You know, I feel really bad when these things happen, because, as I say, people stereotype prisoners, and it shouldn't, because we have an epidemic in this country of mental illnesses and also addictions. And a lot of these addictions are not something that these people wanted to get into. A lot of them were given medication for pain or surgery or whatever, and a lot of them are using drugs and alcohol to cover up pain of things that happened to them in their lifetime, childhood traumas and things like that. But this is what goes on in these prisons, and it's so sad, because recently a prisoner, after suffering for almost a year and a half, was operated on his shoulder, and the correctional surgeon removed not only the cartilage, but part of the collarbone. This prisoner knew that didn't have to happen, because he was a four-year biology major, and he was a physical therapist assistant for some time before going to prison. He asked her not to do it, and she promised she wouldn't, and after they put him out, they removed the cartilage and part of the collarbone. They did the same thing 5 years ago with the knee, so it's bone on bone. This prisoner was a victim of child molestation years ago. And weightlifting, he started at the age of 13. It was the only thing that kept him coping, and they took that from him. And he's been devastated. I did some research and found out this happened to about 5 or 6 other prisoners at some point in time who had been filing lawsuits or grievances. And when they had the surgery, they had permanent damage done to them. And 3 of those cases were by the same surgeon. So these are some of the things that people are not aware of. And that's why, Jeffrey, I am so thankful that you're out here going around the country talking about these issues. Because as a lawyer, there's no reason for you to make these up. And people have to know this is true when they hear it.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Look, I remember I knew somebody. I was walking the bottom cell tier. I remember there was a prisoner there. His last name was Sanchez. We all call them Choco, which is Spanish for, you know, chocolate. And that's what he wanted to be known as. Right. And I passed him by on the walking, you know, he was coming back from the hospital, and he was laboring very profusely to walk, and he was sweating, you know, and I stopped and I saw him. I said, "Yo, you okay? What's going on?" And he says, "Yo, my chest is hurting, but I just came from the sick call, and they told me that nothing was wrong with me. And they gave me some over-the-counter medication, some Tylenol, and they told me to come back tomorrow. But I feel like I'm dying." And, you know, he died that night.
Oh,
he died in his cell of a heart attack. You know, I mean, I have permanent disability. I was playing basketball, and I caught – someone passed me the ball, and it was a lot of velocity to it, and I caught it at an awkward angle. And so the bottom half of my pinky, like, literally went backwards and attached to the back part of the pinky. And so, it swelled up. And the procedure is that when you go to the sick or the medical attention, you see a nurse. You don't see a doctor. And often by the time you see a doctor, it's 1 month or several months. So by the time I got to see a doctor after that, which was 2 or 3 months after that, but by that point, it had like hardened into this permanent position. And when the doctor looked at everything and he said, well, because you have partial movement on your pinky, I'm not signing off on that. I'm not signing off on the state having to spend money to bring you to an outside doctor and get treatment for it. So these are just two examples of terrible medical neglect in the prison system. And, you know, there have been doctors in other states that were working as doctors employed by Department of Corrections, and they weren't even properly certified.
I was talking to I'm going to be talking to Louise Caccione about you too, because I'd like to have you on her show. But Louise has a radio show, and Louise is the director in Massachusetts of Cure National. Charlie Sullivan is the founder. He and his wife founded it in 1975. But they, Citizens United for Rehabilitative Errands. And we were talking about that on her radio show this morning, is the things that are going on in these prisons today. And it's really a shame, because there's so many people that are going into prison and they're not getting the treatment. And she was talking about, she worked in mental health for years and the Department of Mental Health. And I was saying, prisons need to be replaced with long-term residential treatment facilities. You know, mental health issues, addictions, anger management, they need to be replaced, because prisons are not the answer. Miriam Jacobs from the Netherlands, when she comes on, she speaks about the differences, the comparison between the prisons in other countries and the ones in the United States. The ones in the United States are built more or less like the Nazis. You know, it's a strictly punishment. There's no room for rehabilitation. And she says this country, which is true, it consists of a lot of anger, hatred, racism, you know, the retaliation, all these things. How can anybody be reformed in cases like this? But one of the things is, I started the petitions several months ago to do away with prisons and turn these prisons into long-term residential treatment facilities. They closed down all of mental institutions. And unfortunately, American Psychological Association needs to be more involved. They're getting all this money for research, but they should be working with lawyers like you, Jeff. They should be working with others that are trying to do this prison reform, even the politicians. Work with them rather than just stay on the outside looking in, because they know the prisons are full of mentally ill people. Above all, they're the ones that know, so they should be advocating for changes within the penal system as well.
I definitely agree that they need to, you know, jump in and to advocate. And, you know, we need all these different segments, you know, just to jump in and advocate. And, you know, there's a lot of trauma that's experienced in prison, and that's another need for recharge. I mean, you know, just to have a vehicle for expressing, you know, what you experienced or what you saw. And in terms of rehabilitation, I completely agree. Whatever rehabilitation takes place in the prison, it's despite the system, not because of the system. And to that effect, you know, we do have recharge, which is in prisons across the country. Maybe Leslie, you can just briefly mention like the stats and some of the
facilities
where it is.
Yeah, it's used in at least one program in about 25 states. Rikers Island walks 65 games. And I had the opportunity to train all the counselor supervisors while doing a 2-hour workshop in maximum security. So they use it in all their adult programs. It's used in almost every prison in New Jersey. Ohio bought a few hundred, and they're used throughout prisons in Ohio. We're looking to do the same in Illinois right now. And the success rate, one quote is, the success rate is astounding. Because, you know, it takes away, it's not like, you know, there's something wrong with you at all, right? It's like, here's a game to play to talk about your experiences and to talk about what's happened in your life and to bond and share. So it comes from such a very different intention from a lot of these evidence-based programs that are sort of forced onto people. And in fact, in a number of prisons, they use it to try to engage people who are inside because they don't feel the evidence-based programs are relevant, that they are required to deliver the institutions. So they use recharge to get people engaged so that they can then deliver the evidence-based programs. So, you know, hopefully one day things will be, really helpful rather than all these programs that are, what can I say, maybe not coming from the heart.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I want to mention, you know, I did meet with a couple of mental health people employed to do mental health functions. Let me say it that way. came across very, I'm trying to be, I think everyone understands what I'm saying, but not saying, right? You know, I was just a number to them. They were not caring. They were just there for a paycheck. There was no empathy, you know, and a lot of the programs, I mean, simply didn't work. I mean, there was they had RSET, which was called, which was an acronym for residential substance abuse training. And so they had this cell block where please mute yourself when you're not I'm speaking. So the residential substance abuse training, and then they had all these people with drug issues in the prison. So you had the drug sellers and the drug users, and there was more drug using going on in that part of the program than anywhere. And so a lot of these other programs, like, you know, aggression replacement training, you know, again, I don't feel like it was really an atmosphere that was really conducive to rehabilitation. It was just by this instructor that all of us were kind of wary of. Nobody had their guard down. Nobody discussed anything real. In my opinion, it was just about accumulating a certificate to say you did it, as opposed to any type of genuine, authentic human interaction that was towards healing, that was towards rehabilitation. And so to that extent, you know, I'm happy, you know, to have a little bit of a light there in the prison system with recharge.
I'm glad you mentioned
Thank
that because
you,
I was going to see a lot of people. And I also want to say real quick, Jeff, you had mentioned, Leslie, you're going to have to leave in about 15 minutes. But what I'd like to do is I'd like to pick up on this next week if we can continue it and have you back on, both of you back on next week as well.
Yeah, I would very much like to do that.
Would it be possible to be a little bit earlier, or is that not?
Yes,
possible?
Anytime. You can send me the convenient time for both of you, and I can just I can change it in the agenda here. But
okay.
what Jeff was saying is true. You know, since this pandemic started in March of 2020, and I was going to say it started right around the Passover. Not only the Passover of the Jewish people, but also the Passover of the Christ death. But one of the things we have since that pandemic, there were no visitations. Everything was put on hold or suspended. And yet the drugs are still getting in because prisoners are still getting high. So how does that account when they say it's the family members or the friends that are sneaking it in when they're still getting high and there has been no visitation? Plus the fact, if you go on the internet and you type in "God's caught smuggling drugs in the prison," there's a whole list of them. It just goes on and on. So that's another issue. And you just mentioned the issue of the drugs in the prison, and I just had to get that out there, Jeff.
Yeah, 100%. I'm glad that you did. And I want to make another point regards to drugs in prison. So I feel very strongly that drug addiction is a public health problem, and therefore, you know, rehabs and treatment should be employed rather than incarceration. So where I was in New York, we had the Rockefeller drug laws in effect before those were changed. But even after it's changed, it still didn't affect everybody. And so people were doing 15, 20, 30-year prison sentences for an arbitrary amount of drugs. There was over a certain amount, but it wasn't even necessarily something large. So to show you how absurd it was, I saw people walking around. I interacted and saw prisoners walking around in the prison, 20 and 30-year prison sentences, and they had more time than other prisoners who were there who killed people and committed acts of violence. Then there was prisoners returned back to prison you know, dirty urine for smoking marijuana, and they were back in prison for a year or 2 years. So a few years ago, I think the stat was it was more than $70,000 a year per year to incarcerate a prisoner, at least in New York. And imagine for technical violations, like such as, you know, doing marijuana or doing drugs. You know, if someone is doing drugs, they have an addiction. That's an illness. You know, they need treatment. Okay, I know it can't be condoned, but we're not talking about that. We're discussing whether or not the appropriate response should be incarceration for a year or two with these draconian sentences that were imposed. And some of the people are still locked up even now today under those laws.
And it's so hypocritical because if you think about it, marijuana just became legalized across the country.
Mm-hmm.
And look at the people that are serving all these times, this time in prison because of marijuana usage and things like that. And like you say, Jeff, a lot of them are still sitting in prison. But I think the lawmakers, they make the laws according to what benefits not them, but maybe their loved ones or their friends, because it wasn't legalized. There's so many things that are happening now that are becoming legal because people, it's getting into the families of others that no one would ever think it would have gotten into. People that are influential, powerful, and it's happening with their own loved ones. So now a lot of these things believe they're making it legal because they know eventually their loved ones are going to get caught with it.
Yep. Yeah, I agree with that. I mean when it was a big thing when the drugs, you know, come into the white neighborhoods and not really so much of a problem when they come into minority neighborhoods. But then the ironic thing, though, is, and I have a problem with this, which is that there is selective enforcement. There's selective law enforcement with respect to drugs.
Yeah, that's another thing.
Mm-hmm.
That's another thing. I don't know. There's just so much that we have to look at in this day and age, and we need our policy makers. And unfortunately, I believe it was you that mentioned the other day when you were interviewed on Lauren Strang's show, you mentioned, and it made a lot of sense, what was it, the voting rights. So many prisoners have said the same thing, and I think it's only right that taking away somebody's voting rights, especially a citizen of the United States of America, because someone commits a crime, what does that have to do with a bag of beans? I mean, it just doesn't make sense to take somebody's voting rights away, to take somebody's citizenship away in a case like that.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I completely agree. Look, the politicians set the laws, they pass laws, and, you know, that affects everybody. That affects everybody in society. So why should people not have a say? You know, so I mean that's part of that's an essential part of you know, being a U.S. citizen, and it's extremely important to be able to vote and to vote. So actually, look, people were sick enough to kill to stop people from voting, and there were other people who were ultimately lost their lives in the course of trying to register to vote, trying to vote, and fighting for the votes of others. So clearly, you know, voting, you know, is extremely important. You know, and I strongly believe that voting people in and out of office, whoever is not for justice reform, let's vote them out. Let's vote in other people of either party. Go ahead. You want to say something, Les? I don't want to cut you off.
Yeah, I was just going to say, that's incredibly demoralizing to know you don't even have the right to vote in your own country on top of, you know, whatever might have led to, you know, very often people come out of very violent neighborhoods and, you know, they've already had everything stacked against them from the start. So, you know, the demoralization of then on top of all of that, not even having the right to vote and have a voice in your country, you know, it's just
and then being,
really devastating.
And then being talked down to all the time by the COs, the prison officials, called animals, useless, no good, and feeding them. Have you seen it? Feeding them food with maggots in it, feeding them food that is leftover food that other prisoners have had, taking bites out of it, leaving food in the chow hall with flies all over the place. There was one girl, she said her husband or her boyfriend worked in the chow hall. and was telling her about all the gross things that they saw, he saw with the food, and they're giving it to these people. So with everything else, it's terrible.
I worked in food service in Elmira Correctional Facility from years 2002 to 2006. I held a variety of different positions, and I wanted to share that the food service. We were always failing the health inspection. The prison was Elmira was always failing that. There was this terrible routine, so there would be like a regional supervisor. And so the food service administrator who ran things, he would always get a heads up that the regional supervisor was coming. And when he would come, like, he wouldn't come in to work that day. And since I was the clerk, he would come looking for me and say, well, why is this way? Why is this not being done? What's going on with here and there? So always failing it. You had that thing. And when it would be a few days before that supervisor would come, that's when all of a sudden there'd be this big effort at, you know, cleaning things and to try to put the dog and pony show on for that. And another thing I wanted to mention to you is a lot of times, you know, food would be old. I mean, items might make their way onto the menu three times before making its fourth and final appearance for that week in the so-called soup for the dinner meal. You know, everything had been served out already. They would just dump all the leftover ingredients into this huge vat. They would dump water on top of it and heat it up and serve it out. And that's what would be quote unquote soup.
That's sick. One prisoner said that he actually had to eat it. He said he ate it because what they did, they were starving them. They weren't giving them enough food. And finally, when they decided to give them this gunk, this stuff that they just ground it up and served it to the prisoners, they were so hungry, they were eating it. They had no choice. But the budget, I have to say, we're taxpayers. And I'm sure there's a lot of taxpayers against prisoners having anything, but there's a lot of taxpayers who are for prisoners having decent, humane food and living conditions.
Yes.
I'll tell you, speaking of the budget per prison, you know, I would love to know what that money per prisoner is actually being spent on. On a yearly basis. I'd like to know what is it, because I mean, certainly not going to food. The medical care is terrible. You know, everybody did everything they could to avoid wearing the prison clothes. I mean, you had to wear the pants, but you got a personal shirt or personal T-shirt, socks, underwears, you know, sneakers, whatever personal you were able to wear, you did that. Nobody wanted to mess with the state stuff. So I'd like to know, what was that money actually spent on?
And they're even taking they're taking their televisions. They're taking their books. Look at one prisoner. They took his law books. They gave it to the prison library. This prisoner has been in a cell for 22 hours a day for 17, 18 months now with no books, with no TV. You know, he's got a dictionary, and I think he's got one or two other books. But everything else they kept, his sneakers, his robe, his legal document, it's a mess. And how many TVs have they taken from prisoners, and what do they do with them? Probably have given them away to friends or family, their own.
About correctional officers wearing body cams? Now that we're having, you know, such a move for police accountability, hopefully they'll eventually move over to correction officer and system accountability, right? The whole system. I mean, right now everybody's talking about police systems, but, you know, let's like extend the conversation, right?
Yeah, I think that's a really good idea. You know, there was cameras when prisoners are escorted to and from solitary confinements, and you know they had the camera was mandated, because there was physical abuse. But but there would be stuff going on sometimes prior to the camera being turned on, and the prison has different cameras, and there were the certain blind spots, and I think having the cameras to know what the, you know, what actually is going on is
important.
But
even even if not cameras, I mean, why don't we extend this massive nationwide conversation about police accountability to prisons, right? I mean, it's a logical extension.
It really is a logical extension, and you know, part of the problem in everything in this too is that the courts are, you know, there used to be actually a formal doctrine and called the hands-off doctrine, which basically the courts were just hands-off of anything that went on in the prison, you know, on the theory that, you know, judges are not correctional experts. They don't have any expertise in this, and that the official prison officials know what they need to do. And even though that has changed now, at least per law, in practice, it is much the same now. All Department of Correction has to do is say security. It doesn't even matter if when you push past that phrase, well, what's your rationale for how is this security or that security? You know, abuses in prison, you know, are often not reported because the supervisors often were correction officers themselves. And, you know, maybe as we talked about before, maybe related, the prison administration knows what's going on. They look the other way. You're inviting retaliation if you file a grievance or make a complaint, and you're simply taking a risk if you go to outside court. And at the end of your risk, if you decide to brave it, the court is probably going to dismiss your case anyway. So it's really it sets the stage for this lawlessness and beyond the law, you know, and all that's counter to rehabilitation.
Yeah. In Massachusetts, they have a lot of coalitions right now that are working on the solitary confinement issues. There's another coalition working on with the sentencing project to do away with life without parole. There's another one that's working on restrictive housing. You know, there's another one that's working on free calls. But all these coalitions should be working together. I think they'd have a lot more success. And I think they need to do something with the state by state. I think federal prisons are so consistent. These state prisons, the problems are still the same throughout the country in every state, but the operations are different. Nothing is consistent in this country. When you take a child in a family, you take a home, you're going to find if there's a lot of inconsistency, there's not any normality in the home. But if it's consistent and everything is done the same, then you see everything is more normal. That's what's happening in this country. Everything is so dysfunctional because everything's being done differently by state.
Yeah, I'm so sorry. I'm going to have to go. I wish I could continue this conversation with you. Thank you, Liana, so much for this opportunity. And Jeff and I will figure out today when we can be back tomorrow. And I look forward to hearing from you tomorrow. And goodbye, everybody listening. Thank you and bless you all.
Thank you, Leslie. Thank you. And we'll see you next. We'll talk with you next week sometime.
Absolutely. Bye, Jeff. Thank you so much.
Always, Leslie.
Always.
Yeah, I'll tell you, you and Leslie seem to work good together as well. And
yeah,
that's consistency.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I understand where she's coming from. She understands where I'm coming from, and I like the people that I collaborate and work with, you know, as chemistry, and I think that us, you know, getting to know each other personally, and as she mentioned, you know, traveling to various places throughout the country, and you know, getting together socially as well is super important, and that is part of working in coalition, albeit that's a coalition too. But you know, even just getting to your broader point, you know, I think that coalitions are a great thing. I mean, the era of go it alone, you know, I think is over. It wasn't all that effective. So working together in coalition is great. And yeah, large coalitions should try to partner with each other. You just agree on a small agenda, one or two items. You don't have to take up every single issue. Your coalitions can still champion the individual issues you're working on, but agree on one or two things and join forces on those two things, make collective efforts. And then as to the efforts of the separate coalitions, I mean, one coalition that's not pushing the other set of issues, more than likely they're going to be in moral support of them. So what you do is you write a memo of support for that other effort and get the groups inside that coalition to also do the same. I remember in New York when we sent a letter to Governor Cuomo encouraging him to sign the bill, the Commission on Prosecutor Conduct, so independent oversight for prosecutors. In that final letter that we sent to him, we had over 125 organizations, you know, and our sign-on letter, and that was very powerful. And that I know that that played a role in, you know, the governor deciding to sign that bill.
Mm. Yeah, they say success in numbers.
Yeah, strength in numbers for sure. Yes.
You know, I have a lot of respect for Governor Newsom in California.
Yes.
He is so, I just love to hear about him. I love to hear him talking. And he's done so much as far as releasing incarcerated individuals. He was on TV the other day talking about, this is the United States. He was so disappointed in what's going on in this country right now. And I totally agree with him. But he, above all of these states, and with these governors, he's doing more, I think, than any other governor in the country in the way he's releasing people and the way he's doing it in a positive way, you know, in an organized way. I have a lot of respect for him.
Yeah, no, I do too. All these different criminal justice reform measures, you know, that the bills go to his desk and, you know, he signs them, unlike what happens in a lot of other states when bills go to governors and they veto the bills.
Yeah, the governor we have here has not released anybody. And even though the parole board has recently recommended the release of one, this was a former Marine, the governor has not signed anything. I think the governor wants to be liked by his peers more than doing the right thing that he knows he should be doing. But we have that happening around the country. So, Jeff, tell us a little bit about the speaking engagements that you've done, the traveling you've done throughout the country, bringing awareness, and tell us a little bit about that as well.
Sure. So in terms of speaking engagements, I mean, I've spoken I spoke at El Paso, Texas. It was the first ever conference, international conference on false confessions and interrogations. It was co-sponsored by the American Psychological Association, and I went and spoke there. I did a lot of speaking engagements in Connecticut, so I collaborated with Connecticut Network Against the Death Penalty, and they used to parachute me into various battleground districts in that state, you know, en route to our abolishing the death penalty legislatively in Connecticut, which is, nearby New York. So I've spoken at law schools. I've been at Roger Williams Law School in Rhode Island. I've spoken at professional work in front of professional organizations. So, for example, Northeastern Association of Forensic Scientists. I've spoken in front of NYCASA, which is a coalition against sexual assault. I do position justice reform as about justice and accuracy, not against prosecutors or cops. Definitely against rogue cops and prosecutors. And I'm very clear on my message that, it's not a few bad apples, okay? All this injustice afoot wouldn't be the case if it was a few bad apples. But not everyone in the profession is bad either. And so I have been able to speak in front of groups of prosecutors and judges. And I've spoken at the last 7 years, I've co-taught at the Bergen County Police Academy to police cadets. So I've spoken at those places. I've done some international work. For example, I did a tour in Argentina, a series of speaking engagements there and media events and meeting with governmental officials, collaboration there with Fabian Camaño was an advocate. He has the only books on wrongful conviction that are in Spanish. So I did a week-long series of events there, and I went to Armenia, the country of Armenia, and worked with the advocates over there. And Greg Hampikian, who's a scientist who heads the Idaho Innocence Project. And again, the format is we do public speaking engagements, we do media events, we meet with some of the elected officials, and we try to encourage them to adopt changes, you know, in their justice systems. Because as bad as this one is, and it really is bad, a lot of other countries, it's far worse. Of course, like you mentioned, Netherlands and Norway and some of the other places in Europe, you know, they're way ahead of the U.S. in terms of prison reform. But some of the prisons in other countries. I mean, when I was in Armenia, one of the prisoners mentioned to me, well, that they recently had put a gym. They'd recently put a gym in, and that was a big thing. And that the prisoners were given like every month they were given every month they were given like 3 phone calls, and he bragged that if when they're given their 5-minute call, if they didn't get through, they're allowed to make a third attempt later on, and you know, he thought that that was such a big thing. So it's a lot of work needs to be done, and you know, that's also part of why not just the speaking engagements, but I like doing, you know, media and new media, because we need to get more advocates and activists out there. You know, this is far more than all of us doing the work can do. I mean, we need it all hands on deck. We need more people getting involved, and like we talked about last time, we need the financial resources, and you know, we need to get funding. I mean, enough funding for people that are just going to rabble-rouse in the street a little bit and have no agenda, have no specific ask, are not working towards any changes, and at the end, it's all just going to fizzle. I mean, it kind of reminds me of the Occupy Wall Street movement, where at the end of the day, there's not one single change that could be pointed to that changed for the better. It was just a bunch of energy and hype and no substance and no specific ask.
I'll tell you, there's a lot of philanthropists out there that would fund what you do, a lot of them. And I want you to give your contact information for anybody. And another thing is law students. There's a lot of universities. I registered my organization with there's a lot of universities where students are crying out to be involved in some of these nonprofit or some of these organizations and businesses to get the experience, to do their internships, you know, just because they see the injustice and they're tired of it. So sometimes contacting the Harvard Law School and some of these other Northeastern and other law schools, and let them know if they have any if they have any students that want to get the experience or do the internship, send them your way or send them to somebody's way. But real quickly, before you give your information, Jeff, I just wanted to go back to Death Row, because there's a lot of people in the community that talk so much about these people in prison, that they've committed murders, that they've done this and that. What about those people that are so vengeful, so retaliative, that they vote and they push for the death penalty, only to find out a lot of these people that are executed years later through DNA have been found wrongfully convicted, like you were? I mean, what do you say to that?
Yeah, I think that you're making a very valid point. I mean, look, there is a definite risk of executing innocent people. You know, there have been recent executions. Larry Swearingen, Sedley Adley, they were executed. One in Texas and Adley in Tennessee. These men were executed while not being given DNA testing. They were executed without being given any DNA test. Yeah, Liddell Lee just was posthumously, he received the DNA testing after he had been executed. His lawyer's request to conduct additional DNA testing before he was executed, you know, that was denied. And, you know, he was executed without being given DNA testing. Other people, you know, have been exonerated off of death row, more than 100 people. And so many other objections in addition to the death penalty. First of all, if a victim is white rather than is black, then the defendant is much more likely to receive the death penalty than the other way around. So there's kind of a devaluing of life that goes on there. Certainly defendants who are people of color are more likely to receive the death penalty as well. You'll never see somebody rich on death row, so there's definitely a class issue there. There's a certain arbitrariness about it, so it depends on what the politics are of the local district attorney of whether they're going to seek the death penalty or not. So in that aspect of it, it is a little bit arbitrary. Many people think that the death penalty is a deterrence, that it will deter, but in fact, states that have the death penalty have the highest homicide rate. Nobody is thinking, well, I better not commit this murder because I'm going to be executed myself if I do. Nobody thinks that. In fact, there's the opposite effect, brutalization, you know, which is when there's a state-sanctioned execution, there's often a spike in murders in that area after that. I think that killing people who kill in order to show that killing is wrong is circular reasoning. I do believe it does lower society down to the level of the murderer. Then it's a tremendous waste of resources. So in 1995 to 2004, for example, $200 million was spent in New York on a death penalty system. At the same time, nobody was executed. So the money could have better went for crime prevention, social programs, et cetera. So it does waste money as well. And a lot of murder victim family members say that the death penalty doesn't bring them any healing. In fact, the increased publicity around the cases tears the scabs off. It makes it difficult to heal and move forward. And we've had the disturbing practice of prosecutors going ahead, seeking death penalty, going ahead with seeking to get the executions carried out over the objections of crime, murder victim family members. And to me, that's extremely disturbing.
I'd like to carry this on for, and Jeff, if you can give your information, contact information before we end.
Yeah, sure. So I have a website, www.deskovic.org, D-E-S-K-O-V-I-C. There's a web form that people can email me through that. My email address, if you want to go direct, is jeff@deskovic.org. I am on Facebook, LinkedIn, Instagram as well. You can message me through any of those applications, and I do answer my messages personally.
You can also find Jeffrey on just by typing his name in. And
yeah, absolutely. Listen, thank you once again. It's been a great two shows with you. I'm anticipating many more ones in the future. It's great being on the air with you, and thank you for sharing your platform and spending the time and effort that you do at raising up these issues and giving me another medium through which to get my words and message and
Your case is interesting, and everything about you, I just love it. And the caller is still, they probably are just listening in. Sometimes they do. The number shows up a lot, so they're probably listening into the show. But I want to thank the caller for being on with us as well, for listening to the show, and hopefully you'll ask some questions the next time we're on. Again, Jeff, I want to thank you so much for being on with us. This is Jeffrey Deskovic. Wrongful conviction turned into a lawyer and also a nonprofit organization that he has. Thank you so, so much, Jeff. We are now going to be closing, and I thank everyone for being on with us.